Are you a mother who has experienced the unimaginable loss of a daughter to domestic violence? Or perhaps you know someone who has faced this heartbreaking tragedy? Well, we have an event that is tailor-made for you. Join us on September 9th in Los Angeles for the Mother's Brunch, a special event co-organized by Massage and Horror Murders in partnership with the Mikeyana Johnson Foundation for Abused Women and the Nan Washington Global Wellness Foundation. This event is dedicated to honoring the mothers who have lost their daughters to domestic violence. Picture a supportive environment where mothers can come together, share their stories, and find solace among others who have experienced a similar pain. You'll have the opportunity to connect with other mothers who truly understand your journey. The Mother's Brunch is not just about healing. It's also about celebration. Indulge in a delicious brunch spread, savor the flavors, and enjoy the company of fellow mothers who have walked the same path. The event will feature live music and heartfelt remarks from inspiring keynote speakers. We invite all mothers who have been touched by domestic violence to attend this empowering event. And if you're someone who wants to support this cause, we welcome your contribution as a donor. Together, we can make a difference. To reserve your spot at the Mother's Brunch on September 9th, please register on Eventbrite. The link is in the show notes. Let's honor the memory of beloved daughters and find strength in each other. The Mother's Brunch, where healing and celebration meet. Woo, y'all. Getting this week's episode together has been an act of God and Congress, believe me. And as you see, it is still late. Between work, mothering, and co-planning the Mother's Brunch, life has been really, really hectic. And quite frankly, I am exhausted. So, thanks for bearing with me. This week's episode takes us to Michigan again and back to Texas. I swear, we are in Michigan and Texas all the time. I guess there are just so many horrible stories out of those states as it pertains to Black women. It's kind of crazy. And to be honest, Black femicide is a national problem, and I bet we can see horrible evidence of it in just about every state. It's actually kind of overwhelming. It is overwhelming. Sometimes I can hardly stand to read about any of the things happening to women and girls across the country, and today's stories are no different. Please be advised that both of today's stories are about little girls, and both investigations are open and active, so there isn't a lot of public information about them, which is why I combined two stories into one episode. So let's get into it. I'm Renetta Rideout, and this is Massage and War Murders. It was after 11 p.m. on July 2nd, 2023, and 2-year-old Winter Cole Smith and her 1-year-old brother should have been sleeping safe and soundly in their room. They lived with their mom, Samari Cole, and on this night, they weren't alone. Samari's ex-boyfriend and the father to her son, 26-year-old Rashad Malik Trice, was with them, and it was the farthest thing from a peaceful visit. Samari and Trice argued about money, and as their tempers flared, the situation went from contentious to violent. According to the criminal complaint filed by FBI Special Agent Christopher J. Rodolico, it stated that things got so bad, Samari and Trice stabbed each other. Phil Helsel reported for CNN News that in self-defense, Samari stabbed Trice. I haven't come across anything that reports specifically what happened that provoked her to stab him, but it must have been life-threatening because she did do so, but not fatally. In fact, despite his injuries, he overpowered her still and proceeded to stab and then sexually assault her. When the attack was over, Trice allegedly ran out of the apartment. Thankfully, Samari survived that attack and also ran out of her apartment and down the hall to her mother's apartment for help. FYI, here's where things get a little fuzzy with the timeline and things just aren't clear, so bear with me. I also don't know how long Samari stayed at her mother's house and whether or not she returned to the apartment when the police arrived or before. I've read and heard a couple of versions of what might have happened. Some report Samari was discovered by police and then they learned Winter was missing, while others report Samari came back to the apartment and discovered Winter was missing. But in both accounts, one thing is crystal clear. Winter was missing. According to the criminal report I mentioned earlier, the Lansing Police Department searched the apartment and the complex thoroughly, hoping that maybe they'd find her there somewhere. But after searching everywhere for at least a couple of hours, the conclusion was drawn that Trice had abducted the 2-year-old. So now they need to switch tactics and look for him. I'm not sure if Samari or someone else told them, but it became known to police that Trice stole Samari's white 2013 Chevy Impala. Armed with this information, LPD took to Facebook at 12:29 a.m. on July 3rd and advised the community that Winter was missing and that, quote, "This is a very urgent situation," end quote. The post didn't provide any details about Winter beyond her name and age, not even what she was wearing. But it did include a bolo or be on the lookout for the car and the license plate number. But there was no mention of the issuing state. A little more than 2 hours later, at 2:41 a.m., an official Amber Alert was issued for Winter. Apparently, the first of the year for the entire state, as reported by Christina Hall for Detroit Free Press. FYI, the Amber Alert is a broadcast emergency response established in Fort Worth, Texas, after Amber Hagerman was abducted in 1996. It's the collaboration between law enforcement and the media in an effort to locate missing children. The alert system has very specific guidelines for activation, which include that law enforcement has to believe that a child under the age of 17 years of age has been abducted and are in imminent danger. They also have to already be entered into the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And lastly, there needs to be enough information known about the abduction to share with the media. The goal is to disseminate information about the missing children as fast and as wide as possible. To date, all 50 states plus Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands use the Amber Alert. It's even been adopted in 30 different countries. And while that's all fine and good, it's great, actually. I was curious to know how this benefits or impacts Black folks. After all, as of 2019, our kids made up roughly 33% of all missing persons. I looked it up, and surprisingly, Black kids made up 38% of all Amber Alerts activated in 2019. While white kids made up 32%. And again, that's great news, right? Well, not so fast, because Amber Alerts are only as effective as they are visible. In other words, they need to be broadcast in the media so more people have the opportunity to hear about the abductions and therefore can be on the lookout. According to a 2019 study published by Jada L. Moss, Black kids only represented 23% of children documented by the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, a required criterion of the Amber Alert activation. The report goes on to state that missing Black children were only 17% of our nation's top media outlets, the Associated Press and CNN. So, obviously, there are major disparities and discrepancies with these numbers, but let me not take you down a rabbit hole. I digress. Anyway, in Winter's case, the media, both news channels and social media platforms alike, ran with this story. News stations across the nation soon displayed Little Winter's beautiful, tiny face peering back through the screen with her deep chocolate brown eyes. People became invested in her well-being, and soon her pictures were popping up all over social media. Like with any high-profile case, the criminal record of the suspect was brought to the surface, and among those things was a 2021 police report filed by Samari against Trice. Turns out that when Winter was only 3 months old, well before her brother had even been conceived, Samari and Trice had been dating for about a month, and the three of them went to Monroe to house sit for Trice's uncle, where things apparently got way out of control. According to an article written by Christine McDonald and Gina Kaufman for the Detroit Free Press, things became heated between the couple when Winter's father became a topic of discussion. Apparently, Trice was very jealous and got in Samari's face as she held baby Winter. Things continued to escalate, and Trice ended up taking her phone, hurling it across the room. When Samari went to pick it up, Trice shoved her hard, causing her to fall into a lamp while the baby was in her arms. Samari was eventually able to get her phone and call the police. And thank God, neither of them were harmed during that assault. So when the police arrived, Samari and Winter were outside on the sidewalk while Trice was on the front porch of his uncle's house. Samari told the officers that he was carrying a gun and threatened to kill Winter's father. As Samari gave her statement, Trice threw a set of keys at her, and the article said that he like made a point of looking at the officers, like kind of like rubbing it in their faces that he was still gonna do whatever he wanted to do in front of them. So he threw the keys at her and then ran back inside the house. Like, what a little bitch. A little while later, he ran out of the house and the police officer started to pursue him on foot. As the chase broke out, Samari was understandably fearful for their lives, so she ran to the patrol car looking for safety. She was scared that shots would start firing and, you know, she and Winter could be killed. I mean, she was terrified. It was a terrifying situation. Thankfully, the police eventually did catch Trice, and they arrested him, and he was subsequently charged with, quote, 3 counts of assaulting, resisting, or obstructing police, and on 1 count of domestic violence for assaulting Cole, end quote. So now, back to present day, and it's July 3rd, about 4:50 in the morning following Winter's abduction. And 2 St. Clair Shores officers were doing their regular patrol when they noticed a white Impala speeding by. St. Clair Shores is about 93 miles east of Lansing, but the 2 officers are well aware of the Amber Alert and the BOLO for the white Impala. The officer driving tried to pull the Impala over, but before he could even come close, the Impala races down the street and ignited a short but intense police chase. So the Impala is going over 100 miles per hour. And thankfully, the streets are mostly empty because it's super early in the morning. And the original patrol car is right on the Impala's tail. The officers call dispatch and report that they believe they see the car that matches the bolo out of Lansing, but they couldn't be sure without seeing the full license plate, which is hella hard to do with the car so far ahead. Eventually, the Impala makes a hasty U-turn in an attempt to avoid the cops, but in doing so, the pursuing officers were able to see the full license plate, and they then confirmed that, yes, it's on. This is the car we're looking for. And I swear, watching that chase was like watching someone play Grand Theft Auto. It reminded me of those police chases, and all I could think of was, thank God the streets are empty. Can you imagine, like, traffic or just any more traffic, just even a few more cars? Because they were driving crazy. Well, rather, the driver of the Impala was driving crazy and doing all kinds of erratic shit. So I kept thinking that the whole time. Anyway, once again, the Impala made another U-turn, trying to shake the police. This time, many more cars were in pursuit. And just as the Impala sped through the intersection, there was a crash, and suddenly the chase was over. The Impala was disabled and the steering wheel's airbag deployed. Immediately, the Impala was swarmed by cops with their guns drawn, and they're all yelling at the driver to get out of the car. He refuses to comply, so one of the many officers breaks out the window on the driver's side, sending glass flying everywhere. The driver then decides to try to disarm the cop like a dumbass and tries to grab his gun. Stupid, stupid, stupid. Of course, this was a stupid, stupid, stupid move because all that managed to do was piss that officer off and prompted another one to tase the hell out of the driver. I mean, he got to convulsing and carrying on in the driver's seat, and as he was going through that, the officers just dragged him from the car and threw him hard onto the asphalt. And he's bleeding. Like, you can see this. Like, there's blood that gets on the ground. And I'm, like, thinking, where did all that blood come from? But I forgot. You know, dude had been stabbed. Anyway, as soon as he hit the ground, blood splattered everywhere. It was obvious he had some cuts on his face and one big one on his shoulder. And he was bleeding profusely from somewhere in the front. So the driver is now down on the ground and he's resisting arrest. He's wiggling all around, he's flailing, screaming, talking shit, doing the most. And so the officers were just like, listen, we're not gonna go through this. And they tased the shit out of him. At least like 4 or 5 times this guy's got tased during this whole interaction. Eventually, they subdue him. Now, normally when I see a bunch of cops swarm a black man, a trauma response is triggered and I get so anxious and sad, but as you can hear from the excitement in my voice, not this time. They drag this dude to his feet now and they ask him his name. He states loud and proud that he's Rashad Malik Trice. And the police are still manhandling him. Like, there are so many officers. And meanwhile, other officers are frantically searching the car, but it becomes clear very fast that Trice was alone. So they pop the trunk, and I can only imagine that they were scared to even like look. And I even noticed that their body language kind of changed when one of the officers said to someone else to pop the trunk. Like, I could tell that everyone kind of like tensed up even more because no one wants to open the trunk of a car and find a little 2-year-old girl deceased. But the other side of it is they could open the trunk and she'd be alive and yay. So they pop the trunk, but to their disappointment and mine and everyone's, it was empty. Winter was nowhere to be seen. When the police ask where she is, Trice answers quickly. She's in Lansing with her mom. Obviously, they don't buy it, and several more minutes pass as they wait for a medical team to arrive and treat Trice before he's transported. And listen, if you want to see the entire 21-minute video, it'll be included in the list of sources in the show notes. Click on Detroit News wasted no time obtaining and posting the footage, and there's a lot of interesting dialogue on there. Trice tries, unsuccessfully, to garner sympathy from the officers, but they could give a shit less about him or his injuries. However, it was obvious he was hurt pretty bad. Turns out that heavy bleeding he was doing from the front was actually coming from his hip, and that injury made it really hard for him to walk, and apparently to sit down, because when the cops asked him to sit on the curb, he refused, saying that he couldn't. They argued briefly before Trice just was forced down, where he indignantly asked the police if they would treat their own son that way. Of course, they probably wouldn't. Eventually, the fire department shows up and they get Trice, put him on a stretcher, and put him in the back of the ambulance, where he and two accompanying officers are transported to the hospital. Meanwhile, by this time, the FBI is at the scene and they're searching the vehicle, hoping to find any clue that could lead them to Winter. The inside of the car is a hot mess. The driver's side looks like a box of those blue masks exploded all over it. They covered the seat, the floor, and one even dangled from the turning signal lever. There was a huge pile of beaded glass from the shattered driver's window that covered the floor. There was also some sort of card, like maybe a debit or a credit card, on the floor, a pink phone charging cord, and a couple of small bottles. The driver's seat itself also contained a large amount of glass, but the most jarring sight of all was the blood. There was some type of cloth that looked like it could be a towel lying across the driver's seat, and there was blood all over it. There's also blood on the stark white airbag that's hanging from the steering wheel. Special Agent Rodolico described the blood presence in his criminal complaint as, quote, significant amount of blood consistent with Trice's stab wounds, end quote. Meanwhile, back at the hospital, Trice was Mirandized and questioned about Winter's whereabouts. But of course, he claimed he didn't know where she was. He said he never took her from her Lansing apartment, and the last time he'd seen her, she was with her mom. But little did he know, law enforcement used his cell phone data to aid in their investigative efforts. Thanks to a text message exchange with his uncle, the police were able to use that cell data to learn that he'd been to Detroit since he took Winter. That cell data went on to help the police identify the route they believe he took. And from there, the police were able to narrow things down to the area surrounding I-94 and Van Dyke Avenue, where they spent the next several hours canvassing. Finally, about 3 minutes north of the original location, the grid search came to a devastating end. At approximately 6:50 p.m. on July 5th, the tiny body of Little Winter was found discarded in an alley. When she was discovered, law enforcement officers observed a pink cord with her body. Now, in neither the criminal complaint nor any articles I've read has it been explicitly stated where exactly the cord was located, but wherever it was, it indicated the toddler had been strangled with it. It also matched the pink cord that was found inside the car. On July 7th, U.S. Attorney for the Western District of Michigan, Mark Totten, announced that Trice had been charged with kidnapping a minor and kidnapping resulting in death. He's facing a minimum of 20 years if convicted of the kidnapping of a minor charge and the mandatory life sentence if convicted on the charge that resulted in death. Not to mention, the second most serious charge also puts the death penalty on the table. So, we can only hope and expect that at some point, the wheels of justice will turn in the right direction, and this monster will hopefully never see the light of day. On the other hand, no matter the outcome of the court proceedings, there's nothing that can ever undo the irreparable damage inflicted on Winter, her parents, and their families. The grief they must all now live with because they lost their angel baby must be so overwhelming, and my heart goes out to them. In a statement the family issued following the discovery of Winter's body, they touched on a very important part of this whole thing, and it's something that is unfortunately so common. Many of the people who have committed similar crimes against children are usually not one-time offenders. In part, the statement read, quote, "In remembering Winter, we believe it is necessary to make sure that this kind of tragedy never touches any other family, anywhere. We ask the state legislature and Governor Gretchen Whitmer to consider legislation that further ensures that multiple violent offenders remain in jail or prison as they are tragically a threat to all of us," end quote. Trice had a long history of criminal conduct, including domestic violence. But time and time again, he was released into society, free to do whatever he pleased, including, allegedly, murdering a baby. The odd and mysterious case of Amira Diedrich is one I recently heard about. It's another troubling story out of Houston, Texas, and it's baffling. I can guarantee that this one will leave you with far more questions than answers, but considering that she is still missing, I think this is an important story to keep out there. It's the summer of 2013, and Tiara McWilliams is looking forward to the homecoming of her 4-year-old daughter, Amira. She's been in Houston with her father, Anthony Diedrich, and his girlfriend, LaShonda Spikes. Tiara's expecting Amira to be brought back sometime in July, as was agreed upon. This was the first time Amira had been to Houston and stayed alone with her father in all of her 4 years. The timeline in this case is not defined very well, and I don't know exactly when or how Amira was expected to return home, but what I do know is that the more time ticked by without Amira running into her arms, the more concerned Tiara became. Based on a Facebook Messenger exchange reported on by Fox 26 Houston News, Tiara starts blowing up Diedrich's phone, demanding to know what's going on. When she finally connects with him, her heart all but stops at the words he said. He told her that Amira wasn't returning to Wisconsin, and there was nothing Tiara could do about it. You guys, I can't even imagine how I would have spiraled out of control if someone told me my baby wasn't coming home. I'd be so stunned that I probably wouldn't be able to process the reality of those words. I'm sure I'd try to rationalize and deny it, and maybe that's how it was for Tiara, but sooner than later, the reality of the situation began to take root, and she was acutely reminded of Diedrich's threatening words 4 years earlier. You see, Tiara and Diedrich were estranged. In fact, she ran away from him with her newborn. She ran all the way from Houston to Wisconsin in order to escape his abuse, and she remembered in this moment his menacing threat, and that was that he told her she would pay for taking Amira away from him. I'm not sure how, when, or most importantly, why, but Tiara and Diedrich got back in touch after that. Not only were they in contact after she ran away, but they spoke often, exchanging phone calls and pictures daily. Diedrich even came up to Wisconsin to visit Tiara and Amira, and by all accounts, the visit went well. So well that at some point, they began to talk about Amira visiting him in Houston for the summer. I guess she felt confident that things would be okay. She really believed that Diedrich was over whatever happened before and decided to let bygones be bygone. But she couldn't have been more wrong. He hadn't gotten over anything. He just knew how to bide his time and that eventually he'd earn her trust, even if it took 4 years. Abusers don't usually let bygones be bygones. They hold on to grudges and act on them, waiting for the right moment to strike. As these thoughts came flooding into her mind, panic set in and she realized that everything was wrong. From what I could tell, while Diedrich wouldn't allow Amira to go home, he did allow her to talk to her mom, but the calls were monitored by Diedrich and they were infrequent. I'm not sure what happened for the next several months, what action Tiara took during that time, or what Amira's quality of life was like with her father. But in early 2014, Tiara had enough resources to go back down to Houston to attempt to get Amira. Apparently, Tiara did see Amira, but she was not allowed to be alone with her at all, so the opportunity never presented itself for her to snatch Amira up and run. After failing to convince Diedrich to let Amira go home, she said she tried to get the police involved. But she was told that without an existing custody agreement, Diedrich has the same rights she does, and there wasn't anything they could do. If this sounds absolutely bonkers to you, well, you're not alone. Sadly, I can actually attest to this because years ago, I was told the exact same thing. And like Tiara, my daughter had been with me her whole life. Still, without custody clearly defined, the police couldn't or wouldn't assist. It's a very shitty feeling of helplessness that I can empathize with. Tiara mentioned that she did attempt to get help from the court, but nothing came from that. I'm not sure exactly what she did or whether or not she retained an attorney. But whatever she did, it didn't put Amira back in her custody. And after some time, Tiara had to return to Wisconsin without her daughter. Over the next year, the infrequent calls with Amira became more so, and eventually they stopped altogether. Phone numbers were disconnected, messages went unanswered, and then eventually they were unread. All communication stopped completely, and Tiara was left trying to track down where Diedrich had gone with their daughter. But she was getting nowhere. I don't know exactly what action Tiara took during this time beyond calling the phone numbers, but I suspect there was a substance abuse problem because she mentioned in the Fox 26 news interview that eventually she had to get sober in order to really deal with the gravity of the situation. I don't know what she was going through at that time, but whatever it was, I get it. Time continued to pass by without so much as a text message from or about Amira. It's now 2017, 4 whole years since Amira went to Houston, and Tiara gets word that Diedrich had been arrested and was in jail since November 2016. Yes, he'd been locked up for all that time, and no one had seen Amira at all. At 8 years old now, she should have been enrolled in school and at least had an annual checkup every year with the doctor. But Tiara came to know that none of that had taken place at all. This is when she made her way back to Houston in hope of finding Amira. She went to see Diedrich in jail, who'd been locked up for some unrelated charge, and he told her that he met some woman named Linda, who went by the name of Tootie, at a convenience store near Waco. And for some reason, he just decided to give his daughter to this perfect stranger instead of giving her to, maybe her mom? Obviously, horrified by this news, Tiara goes back to the police, and this time, they finally take some action. They go to the jail and question Diedrich, and he repeats his ridiculous story, this time providing them with the woman's address. At some point, they even polygraph him, according to Tiara, but the results of that test remain undisclosed. However, whatever detectives got out of their conversations with him had them trying to track down this Linda, aka Tootie, but they never could. Sure, they went out to the address in Waco, but according to the folks living at that place, there was no Linda among them, nor had there ever been. I don't think they could ever even confirm Linda Tootie actually existed. I also can't tell if the girlfriend LaShonda was questioned at all, because nothing has been said about her involvement or any statements she may have made. You'd think they would talk to her, and I truly hope they did, but who knows? But nothing would surprise me at this point. So at some point, the police end up searching the property where Amira last lived with Diedrich, and they bring cadaver dogs with them. I don't know what led to this action, but I assume they got some type of clue or lead that suggested Amira may have been deceased, and her remains could possibly be buried on the property somewhere. Considering that she'd been missing all that time, I can see why they would have to explore that avenue. Fortunately, this search did not lead to Amira, but unfortunately, things were back at square one with no leads or information regarding her whereabouts. And that's basically where the case rests today. Diedrich did eventually get out of jail in 2020 and has since spoken to Tiara. But his story largely stays the same, and he's never made any attempt to go and get Amira like he has said he would. He just offers up new excuses as to why he hasn't. From what I can tell, he and his girlfriend live not far from Tiara. The National Center for Missing and Exploiting Children has commissioned several age progression photos of Amira over the years, but no one has ever come forward with information about her, and if they have, it never led detectives to Amira, who would now be 14 years old, with her 15th birthday being this year on October 1st. Tiara told the reporter for Fox 26 News that she believes that Amira is with God, but she will never stop looking for her. If you or someone you know has information regarding Amira Diedrich, you're urged to call the Houston Police Department at 713-884-3131 or call the Waco Police Department at 254-750-7500. As always, thanks for listening, and I'll catch you next time on Massage Noir Murders. This is a Savvy Sounds production, written and produced by Renetta Rideout.